And Bonhoeffer made use of his ecumenical contacts in Geneva and in London. He had been a pastor in London for a short time and had been a secretary for the, what was the forerunner of the World Council of Churches, secretary for youth for the World Council of Churches, who had vast ecumenical contacts. And he used these contacts then as part of his role in the resistance movement against Hitler. I was interested in Bonhoeffer as a figure in ethics and in theology, and wanted to know what kind of impact there was on his thought that arose from his being a part of a political conspiracy, and vice versa. What kind of influence on his political decisions, which included even a willingness to be an assassin of Hitler if that was asked of him, what kind of impact on his political decisions did his theology and ethics have? How did they shape those decisions? Well, there's a little bit about myself that also leads into what we, what I want to address this morning. One of the topics that has intrigued me for a long time on Bonhoeffer was a topic dear to him, but which, for some reasons, has not been taken up in 30 years of Bonhoeffer studies, namely, the topic of the meaning of worship in a world come of age. A world come of age is a phrase that is Bonhoeffer's, and we have to talk about what that means. I also chose to do that this morning because I take it that that subject of worship in a world come of age is a subject that is also dear to what Holden is about. We've only been here a couple of days, but it's obvious to me that Holden is a worshiping community. Not only on Sundays, that it has, I think, what Bonhoeffer called the arcane discipline, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, about it, that that's important to it. Also, Holden intends to be kind of wide-eyed and aware of what's going on in the world and wants to be in contact with the world as it is, as the matrix of our lives. So worship and in a world come of age seems to me to be appropriate to be talking about on Sunday at Holden. Okay, well, let me say first that you deserve some fair warning. I'm not going to assume any intense acquaintance with the leading ideas in Bonhoeffer's thought that are important to what I have to say this morning. That means that I'll unpack those ideas as we go along. However, that'll take some time, so I beg your indulgence for about 35 or 40 minutes to lecture so that we've got some common stuff for discussion. I'm reminded of a story about Adlai Stevenson, who addressed the graduating class in the faculty at Princeton University one time, and it's reported that Stevenson began by saying something like this: "I've been invited to talk to you for a while, you've been invited to come and listen for a while. The very best that I can hope for is that we all finish at approximately the same time." I want to lecture for a while, and the best I can hope for is that you finish listening at about the same time I finish lecturing. It is a surprise that this topic, world come of age, has been so little attended to in what are now 30 years and shelves and shelves and shelves of Bonhoeffer studies, because it's clear that it's a topic dear to Bonhoeffer. In those pathfinding theological letters from prison, he asks what is for him always the leading question from his early life on until his death at age 39. He asks, "What is bothering me incessantly is the question of what Christianity really is, or indeed who Christ really is for us today." And then he goes on to say that today is a religionless time, a time when the world has come of age. We've got to talk about what religion means, world come of age means. But this question, who Christ really is for us today, and today a religionless time, a world come of age. That then uncovers a whole bevy of questions for Bonhoeffer, among them the question of what worship is for us in such a time. He writes, "The questions to be answered would surely be, what do a church, a community, a sermon, a liturgy, a Christian life mean in a religionless situation?" And further along, he again asks, "What is the place of prayer and worship in a religionless situation? Does the secret discipline take on a new importance here?" Even more indicative of the importance for Bonhoeffer of this topic is the place that he gave to it in his plans for the future. He was writing what are now published as the Letters and Papers from Prison as simply sort of almost casual epistles to a friend of his, Eberhard Bethke. And when he came upon what was for him a momentous insight of the world's coming of age, he got so excited that he abandoned what he just had told his friend Bethke was his life project, namely completing the book Ethics, and with terrific energy and concentration, he set out to write a new book. It's to our poverty that only the outline of that book survives. Bonhoeffer was so excited about that when he was transferred from the military prison in Tegel to the Gestapo prison and then to the concentration camps, and one is allowed to take only the barest essentials along, he left everything behind, including his books, and took the manuscript of this new book. He had completed about 100 pages. And in the process of moving from Gestapo prison to the concentration camps, somewhere along the line, that manuscript was lost. What we have left of that new book is just the outline that he left behind. But in that remaining outline, cultus, the Latin word for worship, is listed as one of the four main topics in what Bonhoeffer says is the critical chapter, which is entitled The Real Meaning of Christian Faith in a World Come of Age. The notes there are very abbreviated, in fact, frustratingly so. Bonhoeffer simply scribbled, cultus, details to follow later, in particular, cultus and religion. Well, my point is that when Bonhoeffer's thoughts turn to the future and he stakes out his own theological project, the whole matter of cultus or religion or worship in a religionless time has a place that is far from peripheral for him. So I say it's a bit of a surprise that no attention has been given to this topic in Bonhoeffer's studies. Now, if you look at the pattern of Bonhoeffer's life, and not just the stated priorities in his thought and in his project for the future, then the surprise is underscored. It struck me the last time I read Letters and Papers from Prison how pious those revolutionary theological letters are. There aren't many of us that sing with much relish old Paul Gerhardt hymns blending in a romanticist way, pietism and orthodoxy, much less do we memorize verses of a hymn like Fröhlich soll mein Herz singen, gladly does my heart spring up, and commend those memorized verses to our friends. Bonhoeffer did. I guess we sing Amazing Grace or something like that. But that's just an example of the second order. The telling point is that while Bonhoeffer was in prison, at the same time that he is lamenting religion, which is for him a bad word, and at the same time that he's applauding world come of age, a good phrase, Bonhoeffer practices what he calls the arcane discipline, or the secret discipline, regular prayer, regular meditation. He lived by the church year. He often dated his mail by the ecclesiastical calendar. His last action among fellow prisoners was to conduct a worship service on the way to the last concentration camp. And his last action in solitude was to quietly pray on his knees and naked before he ascended to the gallows. So, worship was important for Bonhoeffer in his life, in his thought, in his last days, and in the future that he hoped for. So it's a surprise. This topic of worship in a world come of age has been given so little attention by so many people. Or is it? In that first letter about religionless Christianity, just after that question about the place of worship and prayer in a religionless situation, Bonhoeffer goes on. He says, "I must break off for today so that the letter can be posted straight away. I'll write you soon again about it. The succeeding discussions are just as abbreviated as that, and the typical outcome is that same postponement that we noted earlier, cultus, details to follow later." So you come away rather empty-handed, apparently with little more indication of the topics important than the topics important to Bonhoeffer. So it's not a total surprise that we haven't had much attention to it, because Bonhoeffer himself did not follow through. Again, if you look to Bonhoeffer's life and not just to his unfinished thoughts, we're faced with that common situation in which, while actions certainly do speak louder than words, they often don't tell us what we most need to know. Yes, Bonhoeffer did worship in a world come of age, and though that says a lot, what we shall make of it for his own answers to his own question about cultus in a religionless time, we don't quite know. It may be that Bonhoeffer is like many of us, rather anachronistic, so that he talks radical in his theology, but when the pressure is really on, he acts out of the familiar. He speaks freely and excitedly about a new setting of a religionless world and calls for the non-religious interpretation of biblical concepts, but under stress and in the face of death, acts in a manner marked by the most traditional religious form. So Bonhoeffer's actions, which do speak so movingly, may not yet tell us what we really want to know about this topic. Maybe. There's a final reason why the topic, worship in a world come of age, did not become Bonhoeffer's in the space of those pages that he did leave behind. Bonhoeffer has some convictions about what are priority questions and what are secondary questions. And he believes that you can't answer the secondary questions until you've answered the priority ones. He's utterly serious when he asks the question, "What is bothering me incessantly is what Christianity really is, or indeed who Christ really is for us today." Or in another place, he says, puts down and scribbles simply, "The question is Christ and the world come of age." When these priority questions are answered, then, perhaps, out of the answers will emerge the clues to church renewal, to meaningful worship, to actions appropriate to a Christian style in a drastically altered setting that he calls the world come of age. But that will take a while, a very long time, says Bonhoeffer. He wrote a baptism sermon from prison, and in that baptism sermon is included some of his comments on the future of the church. Remember, this is writing 1943. He writes this to his new godchild. "Today you will be baptized Christian. All those great ancient words of the Christian proclamation will be spoken over you, and the command of Jesus Christ to baptize will be carried out on you without your knowing anything about it. But we are once again being driven right back to the beginnings of our understanding. Reconciliation and redemption, regeneration and the Holy Ghost, love of our enemies, cross and resurrection, life in Christ and Christian discipleship, all these things are so difficult and so remote that we hardly venture anymore to speak of them. Our earlier words are bound to lose their force and cease, and our being Christians today will be limited to two things, prayer and doing justice among men. All Christian thinking, speaking, and organizing must be born anew out of this prayer and this action. We are not yet out of the melting time, and any attempt to help the church prematurely to a new expansion of its organization will merely delay its conversion and purification. It is not for us to prophesy the day, though the day will come, when men will once more be called upon to utter the word of God so that the world will be changed and renewed by it. It will be a new language, perhaps quite different, quite non-religious, but liberating and redeeming, as was Jesus' language. Till then, the Christian cause will be a silent and hidden affair, but there will be those who pray and do right and wait for God's own time. May you be one of them. Now, if the Christian cause is a silent and hidden affair for the foreseeable future, waiting on God's own time and waiting for the conversion of the church, and if Christians are being, as Bonhoeffer says, driven by the world coming of age right back to the very beginnings of their understanding, then it is surely little surprise that the matter of worship in a religionless time must wait out this long labor and endure the pangs of the church's rebirth. And that will be a while, says Bonhoeffer, for clearly the answers to these first-order questions of what Christianity actually is and who Christ really is for us today are not answers that can be quickly or easily given. Okay. I'm told that all these words sort of laid end to end constitute what is understood in the higher echelons of communications as an extended introduction. All I really wanted to say, believe it or not, is that it's both rather surprising and not so surprising that a topic like this, so vital in Bonhoeffer's life and thought, has been so infrequently handled. But let's give it a try. At least Bonhoeffer poses good questions, and I suppose that a really good question is actually an answer in disguise. So while we can't help Bonhoeffer anymore, maybe we can get some help for ourselves with some help from Bonhoeffer and his questions. I think the place to begin is clear. We've got to discern the meaning of world come of age for Bonhoeffer and our religionless situation, to use this phrase. I ask you simply to kind of empty your minds of any content that you might want to put into the word religion or world come of age. But part of the reason I ask that is because if you've done some of the reading in Bonhoeffer studies, there's a lot of misunderstanding of those terms. Also, on the face of it, that couldn't possibly describe our time with this ardent religious quest for meaning, or the continual calling upon God by thousands and millions of churchgoers, or the Jesus movement, or vitality of some of the Eastern religions, or the rise of the occult. There's all sorts of indications of interest in religion. So when Bonhoeffer says, our time, we're coming to a time of no religion at all, one might simply conclude that he's simply wrong, if not altogether stupid. Or maybe he was right, but the times have changed. Now, just kind of put aside any content of religion and world come of age, because Bonhoeffer's terms there are very specific. World come of age. Actually, Bonhoeffer uses that particular phrase very rarely. He usually says, world coming of age, or becoming adult, or some other word indicating process and change, movement. The reference then is not to some settled condition of the world, but of some monumental change taking place. I'm going to use the phrase world come of age rather than coming, just because it's less awkward, but you should think process, movement, change when that phrase is used. World come of age is for Bonhoeffer a double movement. On the one hand, the increasing of human autonomy through the growth of human knowledge and human powers and human accountability, increase of human autonomy, and on the other hand, the decaying of religion. Let's start with the latter, meaning of religion. When Waterford came to the States the second time in 1939, when he was supposed to stay for a while, and he came in part, incidentally, to escape the draft, he didn't stay long. He decided that he could only be faithful back in Germany, and so he went back. But when he was here for those few weeks and struggled with that decision, he went to Riverside Church, New York. And he puts in his diary this paragraph: service in Riverside Church, quite unbearable. Text, a saying from James. The whole thing was a respectable, self-indulgent, self-satisfied religious celebration. That sort of idolatrous religion stirs up the flesh, which is accustomed to being kept in check by the word of God. Such sermons make for libertinism, egotism, indifference. Do people not know that one can get on as well, even better, without religion? Perhaps the Anglo-Saxons are really more religious than we are, but they are certainly not more Christian, at least if they still have sermons like that. I have no doubt that one day the storm will blow full force on this religious handout, if God himself is still anywhere on the scene. The tasks for a real theologian over here are immeasurable, but only an American himself can shift all of this rubbish, and up till now there do not seem to be any around. Just that one line. Do people not know that one can get on as well, even better, without religion? All right, what is religion, without which one might fare better, and from which God might yet deliver us if he's anywhere on the scene? Whatever religion is, whatever else religion is for Bonhoeffer, it belongs to a long-standing but changing, and now for many people, changing, passing consciousness. Terms are important here. By consciousness, I mean a sort of total configuration in any individual that makes up that individual's sense of reality. The sort of the picture of reality that we carry around in our hearts and in our heads. Our worldview, our total perception of things. Now, the first notation that we have to make about consciousness, and this is by way of background, getting Bonhoeffer's notion of religion, is that the content of consciousness, of our perception of things, our worldview, is historically relative. That is simply that it changes from time to time, society to society, age to age, culture to culture, sometimes even within the life of the same individual as that individual moves along. It is also important to note that the picture of reality might be so shared with so many people as to constitute what you can simply call a collective consciousness. That's what we mean when we talk about a civilization or a sense of peoplehood or a culture. We're talking in part about a shared sense of reality, a collective consciousness. But the point is that no matter how individually unique one's sense of reality is, or how widely shared it is, the content of consciousness is historically relative. It changes. Second notation about consciousness is that occasionally in history, a massively shared consciousness undergoes massive changes, and a new way of seeing life, thinking about life, living it out, comes about. Karl Jaspers, the Swiss philosopher, calls these times axial ages, times when time turns a corner, and a fundamental revolution of consciousness, or a conversion in the way of seeing life, thinking about it, living it out, takes place. A new sense of reality dawns. A new horizon appears where the old were. The third notation is that our consciousness is a basic shaper of our needs. Of course, we've all got some basic biological determinants of our needs: food, shelter, clothing. But for the most part, except for this sort of subsistence needs, what we regard as our needs is very much a function of our perception of things, of our consciousness, of our reading of reality. What's all this got to do with Bonhoeffer and worship in a world come of age? A whole lot. Bonhoeffer speaks of religion as belonging to now a long-standing but changing and now for many people a passing consciousness. He suspects that we're living in an axial age and that many people are moving from a religious consciousness to a world come of age consciousness, and that these two are fundamentally different ways of seeing life, thinking about it, and living it out. And when Bonhoeffer says we may be entering upon an age of no religion at all, he's then referring to the eventual outcome of these massive changes of consciousness, changes of content in consciousness. All right. So now we have to say, what does Bonhoeffer mean by religion? Bonhoeffer is rejecting what he calls a religious a priori that is supposedly constitutional to human nature, that we're all born with a need for God and religion, that there's some God-shaped blank that is a part of our being. Bonhoeffer says there is no God-shaped blank in each person's life that must be filled if that person is to live a life of meaning, purpose, integrity. Or more accurately stated, he is saying that if there is some set of religious needs that only God, or at least religion, can meet, then these needs are integral to and relative to the individual's consciousness or the consciousness of a society. A need for God and religion is not, in other words, a given of human being. Humanity as humanity is not homo religiosus, although some men and women are, depending upon their picture of reality. All right, please note that Bonhoeffer is not saying that people, even maybe most people, no longer have a need for God and religion. He is saying that such needs are those of people who possess a particular consciousness, one with a long history, but one with which is now on the wane this time. Furthermore, he is saying that the consciousness of some other people has already altered in such a way that they fare well without religion. Indeed, they fare better than religious people. Now, I just want to make an aside here. Everything that Bonhoeffer writes, even though you can't tell by reading the lines, is autobiographical. He could not write of the place of the involvement of the resistance in his thought, but it's all there. And when he talks about world come of age and contrasts that with religion, he is talking in part about his experience of the resistance movement in which he worked with atheists and agnostics who for him were doing what Christians should have been doing, and his experience in the confessing church where Christians were not doing what they should have been doing. And he wants somehow, and he documents this mentality, this consciousness of the resistance, non-Christians with whom he works as world come of age, and he sees in much of the church religious consciousness. All right, so there are people possessed of world come of age consciousness, and that means for him, in part, that their way of seeing life, thinking about it, living it out, is such that God and religion are not critical to a satisfactory vision of life or to a humane morality or to living lives of meaning and purpose and integrity. What else is Bonhoeffer saying? For us, our topic, it's critical to note that Bonhoeffer's observation is that Western Christianity in all aspects, doctrine, liturgy, ethics, casts its content in the material and the forms of religion. So it took religious foundations for its own footing. That's why Bonhoeffer says that if indeed ours is a religionless time, quote, the foundation is taken away from the whole of what up to now has been our Christianity, end of quote. So in different words, Western Christians have been people who have been possessed of religious consciousness, and now they find themselves in a world, the world come of age, in which that consciousness is in the process of slow expiration. So in different words, Western Christians have been people who have been possessed of religious consciousness, and now they find themselves in a world, the world come of age, in which that consciousness is in the process of slow expiration. Now you can see why what Bonhoeffer calls for is a religion-less consciousness, a religion-less Christianity, and for a world come of age. He says we must become world-come-of-age Christian. He calls for the non-religious interpretation of biblical concepts. And you can see why worship, which has been cast in religious forms or in the rubric appropriate to religious consciousness, you can see why he wonders what meaning and place that's going to have if we're arriving at a time of no religion at all. All right. A little bit more about the religion that he says is decaying and about the nature of God, of the God of this religion. Bonhoeffer means, or says, that for a person of religious consciousness, God, and this is his term now, is a working hypothesis for explaining whatever is unexplainable, or seems so. So that God is the one who handles the unknown in the person's life. God is a working hypothesis to explain what is not known. Back to back with this, you must place one of the characteristics of world come of age consciousness, namely the growth of human autonomy through the increase of human knowledge and powers. That is, he is saying that man in a world come of age, using his autonomous reason, can and does interpret natural and social processes, can and does face life's questions, all without, and I'm using his phrase again, the tutelage of a divinity, all from premises which need not and do not posit God. It used to be that man used God or the gods to account for most everything. Now other explanations suffice, at least as well, so that we can, or put it this way, the known has wholly secular explanations, and these suffice. God is no longer necessary as a working hypothesis for those understandings that allow us to come to terms with our world. Furthermore, of late, and Bonhoeffer just makes some observations along the line, there's been a sort of knowledge explosion so that psychology now can answer questions of guilt, which used to be left to religion. And you can go on through art, technology, law, and politics, the sciences. All right. What are the implications here for worship in a world come of age? Okay. Since in religion, religious consciousness, God is a working is this working hypothesis for explaining the unexplainable, for handling the unknown, then God becomes associated with or situated in the unknown rather than in the known. And so as the known increases, God is removed farther and farther away from the center of life, pressed ever outward toward the boundaries. And then these boundaries themselves are moved back as human knowledge and human powers increase. What happens to religion? It becomes ever more a separated sector of life. That diminishing sector of the unknown, the unexplainable, and the uncontrollable, rather than being a kind of depth dimension in the center of life, in the midst of the known. Religion then becomes a certain sphere of life, rather than some all-pervasive element in life. The God of religious consciousness is also, not just a working hypothesis, says Bonhoeffer, but the deus ex machina. Now, in Greek tragedy, as many of you know, the ancient Greek plays, the normal course of human events would sort of move along, and then when it would arrive at some point where it just simply couldn't bring off something that was essential to the plot, a god intervened from the side, usually from above, I think, did his job, and then the business of life and the plot could move on. That god was the deus ex machina. Bonhoeffer is saying that people of religious consciousness turn to God and turn to religion only, but always, when their human resources fail to accomplish what they want or need done. So God and religion then function to secure solutions of sorts to problems that exhaust us or which we regard or choose to regard as insoluble or interminable. God and religion then function to rescue us from dangers we encounter but we can't control. They function in some grand theodicy, sooner or later, to right all those wrongs that we're simply too tired to right when our passion for justice wanes but our apathy does. The contrast with characteristics of a world come of age consciousness are rather stark here. The growth of human autonomy through the increase of human powers and knowledge and accountability means that human destiny falls into human hands in ever greater measure. But more important, and this is Bonhoeffer right out of his experiences with people in resistance, people possessed of a world come of age consciousness, whose answers are arrived at without recourse to God and religion, are people who regard themselves as irrevocably accountable for their answers to life's questions. Where there is failure, and there surely will be, there isn't any recourse to God and religion to do what needs to be done, to right what needs to be righted. The buck is not passed to God or fate or circumstances or some other religious or quasi-religious account. I maybe should just say in passing, simply because it's messed up so often in the literature, that Bonhoeffer does not mean by world come of age moral maturity. He means moral accountability, responsibility. When he speaks of the adulthood of the world, he doesn't mean that humanity has achieved some moral maturity which it has never had until this time, that we're somehow grown up morally in a way that surpasses any previous age. But he does mean that humanity is responsible for the uses of its increased powers and knowledge, whether those are exercised in a morally mature manner or not. And that world come of age people accept that responsibility. He says there isn't any returning to an adolescent dependence upon a father, even a heavenly father, on whom somehow final responsibility falls for the condition of the world. So for the world come of age people, man's future or man's non-future resides in human hands. All right, if I've not already strayed too far here, you can see the consequences of religion when God is the Deus ex machina. God then, in religious consciousness, is not experienced by people in their achievements and their strength. God is experienced by them in their weakness and in their resignation. Yeah.
My own experience has been confronted again and again by agnostic atheists that, oh, God is just a crutch.
Yeah.
That's the only time they would think of it.
Yeah.
They had to
answer. Yeah. Well, that's what Bonhoeffer is talking to. So religion then, for religious consciousness people, is for people in their trouble, not for people at their best. At their best, they're secular. They're world come of age. They're non-religious. Since God then is at the periphery and dependent upon only, but always, when human powers kind of peter out, then man at his most religious is man most broken, most exhausted, most defeated, most self-denigrating and weakest, while man on his own is man in his self-confidence, achievement, strength, exercises of his powers, active explorer of his potentiality. The God of religion is also, says Bonhoeffer, the God of the gaps, who exists to plug the empty places in our lives. Very closely related. For those of religious consciousness, God and religion function to fulfill the needs they have, but by their own reason or strength cannot fulfill. God and religion, in other words, are there to complete the incomplete. Now, you can imagine a critique to the effect that people of religious consciousness have this crutch God, and that religion works in such a way as to shortcut the development of human powers, the strengthening of character. That is Bonhoeffer's critique, and it's part of the reason why he says people fare as well, indeed better, without religion. If he'd used our language, he would say simply, in cursory fashion, religion is dehumanizing. All right, one last notation about Bonhoeffer's description of religious consciousness. There are two poles in that way of looking at things. And the one pole is a God who is located beyond the world rather than in the midst of it. And at the other pole is the interior realm of the individual that is the place of contact for the self with this God beyond. Religion then is, as Bonhoeffer says, a matter of individual inwardness. God is removed from the world except for his speaking place in the recesses of the soul, and religion is removed from the marketplace, from meaningful engagement in one's public life in the midst of what one knows and does best. Religion then again becomes a separated thing, now this time located in some inner sanctuary to which one withdraws from the world in order to encounter God. Now this is why you can see what Bonhoeffer means now when he scribbled in that new outline for the book. Quote, Pietism as the last attempt to maintain evangelical Christianity as a religion. Pietism as the last attempt to maintain evangelical Christianity as a religion. All right, that's a frightfully skeletal sketch of these matters, religion, God of religious consciousness. Just to say, Bonhoeffer laments religion, applauds world come of age. He laments religious Christianity, religious worship, and calls for non-religious Christianity. Christianity. His laments about religious Christianity are reducible to two. It shrinks God and it shrinks human beings. That is, religious consciousness, especially in a world come of age, ends up shoving God into a smaller and smaller blank, a tinier and tinier place in people's lives, and a place not at the center of their concerns and strengths, but at the edges. God is still big in his place, but he's small in the totality of even religious lives. He remains important for some things, ever fewer, ever more interior, but peripheral for most. So God shrinks. Man shrinks as well, because religion functions in a way as to reinforce people in their abdications of responsibility. It shortcuts getting along without God, that's Boniface quotation, which would help them become more accountable and self-reliant and strong. Now, irony and tragedy wait in the wings, Bonhoeffer thinks. For the church, he believes, will fight the world's coming of age and will do all in its power to save a place for God and religion. The clergy will, in Bonhoeffer's language, use all its clerical tricks to retain religion as a sector of life by marketing certain questions and problems, say death or guilt, to which supposedly only God can give an answer. The irony is that for Bonhoeffer, world coming of age people are in their godlessness closer to confronting the God of the Bible than are religious Christians and the church in their alliance with the God of religion. The tragedy is that the church will be the strongest opponent of the very opportunity to rediscover Christianity and its non-religious roots, and will be the strongest opponent of its own conversion. And I remind you, the essence of conversion is this altered consciousness. So, you might appreciate Bonhoeffer's strong language at this point, or at least you can understand why it is strong, given his ideas here. A paragraph from Letters and Papers. The attack by Christian apologetics on the adulthood of the world I consider to be in the first place pointless, in the second place ignoble, and in the third place unchristian. Pointless because it seems to me like an attempt to put a grown-up back into adolescence, that is to make him dependent on things in which he is in fact no longer dependent, and thrusting him into problems that are in fact no longer problems for him. Ignoble because it amounts to an attempt to exploit man's weaknesses for purposes that are alien to him and to which he is not any longer freely assented, and unchristian because it confuses Christ with one particular stage in man's religiousness. All right. High time to try and conclude what might have been gained from this for the topic worship in a world come of age. A couple things are clear. First, to satisfy Bonhoeffer, worship in a world come of age must strive to be non-religious worship for religionless Christians. If it does not become this, that is, if it remains religious worship in a world come of age, it will participate in that ignoble, pointless, and unchristian apologetics that really tries to soften up in world come of age people a place for God and religion. In Bonhoeffer's language, worship, religious worship in a world come of age, will try to communicate to such people that they are dependent upon things on which they are in fact no longer dependent. It will try to thrust them into problems which are no longer problems for them, and it will play upon their weaknesses in such a way as to smuggle God into some last secret and vulnerable place in their lives. Or, if world come of age people choose to ignore the church altogether, religious worship may well continue, but it will be a part of that worldview baggage of a dwindling number of religious people who are in quiet retreat from the world, people who deludedly believe themselves to be preserving Christianity in the very act of fortressing themselves against those forces which offer the opportunity to rediscover it. So worship then will continue to be meaningful precisely because it is part and parcel of a dying consciousness its relevance to some people will be the flip side of its irrelevance to the world around them. Secondly, and this is a quite different point, religion for Bonhoeffer, and this is why I asked you to sort of leave that an empty category, religion for Bonhoeffer does not refer to, as such, to the liturgical elements of the church, sermon, liturgy, sacrament, scripture, doctrine, prayer, meditation, confession, so on. Any of these things, and all of them, might be interpreted and employed in either a religious or a non-religious manner. Now, let's try to put these together. I'm just going to use some phrases from Letters and Papers from Prison and try and contrast religious worship and non-religious worship. Non-religious worship would, using these liturgical elements, help us to find God in what we do know, not in what we do not know. That would be religious worship, finding God only in what we do not know. Non-religious worship would help us, through these liturgical elements, to realize God's presence in those problems we have solved, not in unsolved problems. That would be religious worship. Non-religious worship would help us to speak of God at the center of life, not on the boundary. That would be religious worship. Non-religious worship would help us to discern, quote, the beyond in the midst of life, end of quote, not point away to some other life and some beyond. That would be religious worship. Non-religious worship would thrust us, quote, unreservedly into life's duties, problems, successes and failures, experiences and perplexities, in such a way as to take seriously not our own suffering, but the sufferings of God and the secular life. End of quote. By contrast, religious worship would aid and abet our efforts, quote, to try and make something of ourselves, whether it be a saint, a converted sinner, or a churchman, a righteous person or an unrighteous one, a sick one or a healthy one. End of quote. Non-religious worship would help us, through these various liturgical elements, to experience God in the meeting with the neighbor and being for him in that meeting. By contrast, religious worship would experience God in this privatized meeting between the single self and God in some interior sanctuary of the individual. Non-religious worship would foster attitudes of daring, creativity, risky responsibility, promote imaginative endeavor, and not only simply attitudes of dependence, humility, and passivity. Those, if those were exclusively the attitudes fostered by worship, would be religious worship. All right, maybe more can be said, yet I think maybe not too much more on the topic, for the reason that I cited earlier, namely Bonhoeffer's conviction that Western Christianity is still so soaked in religious consciousness that the answers to those priority questions of what Christianity really is, and indeed who Christ really is for us in a religionless time, will be answers that are a long time in process. And we can't really be clear about the kind of the gestalt, the form of religionless Christianity, the form of religionless worship, until we are well into those first order answers. I've gone on too long.
This is my nature. The question I was going to ask is, to what extent is he really even transferable from the, say, Swabian piety, which I know well, because I've got cousins who passed it to them right now, to the congregations I've served, which have never had a prayer meeting, and where you never have a Bible fellowship, and where when you were through with confirmation, you were through. We had already come of age.
Well,
I mean, that
obviously that would be tough. Bonhoeffer's own experience and his own sort of model, I think, remained with his experience as leader of the underground seminary in Finkenwalde. Bonhoeffer took over a directorship of an underground seminary that trained pastors for the Confessing Church, which was a church, part of the church that broke off from the rest out of opposition to Nazism within the ranks of the church. Those are other reasons. But anyway, Bonhoeffer did sort of the unheard of thing in that seminary and required of the students a life of piety, so that the beginning of the day was a confession not of a person in solitude to God, but a confession of one person to another of his or her sins. And then each laid the hands on the other. And then there was regular prayer, regular meditation. It looked for all the world like an order, like a Protestant order. And Bonhoeffer has all sorts of notions around that about community. They come up in his little book, Life Together, which is not a book written in order to describe community, but which is just his notes on what, in fact, they did at Finkenwalde. I think, Carol, that what Bonhoeffer is pointing to is a notion of the church somewhat in sectarian or in the style of order, which really asks that people simply commit themselves to this secret, this hidden discipline, and those that don't care to make the commitment are just, you know, somewhere else. There isn't much room here for notion of any kind of sort of nominal membership. It's a small group, and it's a very intense life together. Now, he knows the dangers of that, sort of in the danger of fostering a pietist in-group, out-group kind of consciousness, and that brings up the other pole, which is an identification with secular people, with world-come-of-age people, in their causes, without making any qualification, asking any qualification on their part, theological, ecclesiastical, or any other kind. I would sum it up by saying that there's a very strong sense of Christian identity as Christian on the one pole, and there's a very strong sense of the need for identification of Christians with the causes of social justice. In the end, our being Christian today is reduced to two things: prayer and doing justice among men.
Now, to me, this lecture sounded almost like a commentary on this one quote from Luther that caught Barth's attention was the beginning of their friendship, where he says the curses of the impious are often more precious than tears of God than prayers of pious.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Bonhoeffer is very clear about the absolute necessity of the dialectic, and he is very clear about the dangers on each side of that business. One revives the worst marks of the sectarian style, and the other results in a kind of a burnt-out case, a sort of moral rearmament crusade that soon extinguishes itself for lack of nurture. And because people end up not knowing where they are.
By and large, where do we need more support?
We continue in the swing. In fact, one of the interesting things is that the so-called secular Christianity, which claimed Bonhoeffer as a major inspirer, and Bonhoeffer was, I'm thinking of such things as Harvey Cox's The Secular City. What was interesting there is that those folks never caught the other pole in the dialectic, the importance of worship, liturgy, fantasy, imagination, gestures in the Christian life. And what happened with sort of secular Christianity, where the world wrote the agenda and everyone got in there and did all those things, is that it soon found itself a burnt out case. It had identification without identity. And so Bonhoeffer was a major inspirer of sort of secular Christianity, but it never caught the dialectic in Bonhoeffer. So what happened? People like Harvey Cox, after writing The Secular City, writes a book called The Feast of Fools. It's a grand piece, picking up this other pole. All I'm saying is that I think Bonhoeffer lived out both of them. Resistance, you can kind of typify it, where the resistance movement on the one hand and the intense life of the underground seminary on the other hand.
Incidentally, it was at the very time that Reinhold moved or associated with this Dietrich Bonhoeffer that he wrote his most brilliant polemic against Frank Buckman's moral rearmament, which I love to reread now and then because it was a shabby, despicable affair in most cases.
That's interesting.
Moral rearmament had these rather silly lines that let's pay our attention to important men like Hitler and Mussolini. If we could bring them to God, oh, what a good they could make with their centralized power. Oh, such a whore.
What puzzles me is why in the American scene did that side of Bonhoeffer get picked up and not the other? I mean, when we so obviously deal with congregations which are missionary congregations, I mean, which definitely have to be converted. I mean, I'm thankful they're there. I don't want a European congregation. But at the same time, that's our task. And suddenly by this other side of Bonhoeffer. We did the same thing with Laudentia. I read Swedish because our brother John Augustine says the one thing you never doubt is that a person who draws into the Church of Jesus Christ is related to Jesus Christ. He's a Christian. So everybody carrying his cross out in the world except the pastor within his congregation was obviously false and wrong. And the Laudentian theology doesn't say it either. But that's what we drew from it. Now that's what we drew from Bonhoeffer. The same. The prophetic element in it, we just apply it. So Saul Bellow's Mr. Sam's Planet for me is the best attack on private conscience secrecy. It's a marvelous attack. And he goes back to, here's a Jew, goes back to power and the mystics of Ted Luther in order to once more restore us to something besides a dump in the